Welcome to Denim Talks, Kingpin's podcast about all things denim. This week, we're proud to introduce a special project we've been working on with Lee. In the first episode, Lee's Rowan Atwood and Kingpin's founder, me, Andrew Ola, explore each step of the denim supply chain, discussing the sustainability challenges and potential opportunities to make denim better for the world, better for the environment, and better for you. New Indigood episodes will be available every other Friday. Stream the Indigo podcast on the kingpinshow.com website or wherever you normally get your podcasts.
I think there's a lot of good news with what's happening is people definitely care, and our mills and our partners in the production world know that, you know, our standards are higher and we have to be innovative and think outside of the box.
One of our main targets in the next 5 years to be able to finish stretch fabrics with no water. So we will be able to have the whole chain without any water consumption. Today's a dream, still a dream, but we are getting closer.
In the beginning, everything was possible. Trying products, chemicals, different kinds of way to wash a pair of jeans. Today is very important to achieve a great look, but completely in a responsible way.
From Kingpins and Lee, welcome to the Indigood Podcast, where we celebrate everything good happening in denim. I'm your host, Rowan Atwood, Sustainability Director at Lee, and this is our first episode. You know, there's something special about denim. I mean, you're listening to a podcast about it, and we made the podcast about it, but as a company, Lee has been around for 130 years, and denim has been around for even longer. Since then, there's been a lot of innovation. It's become a globally loved product, but the reality of manufacturing in any industry is that it comes with a certain amount of impact to our environment and sometimes the people that work there. But I have refreshing news. There are a lot of people that make denim that are also passionate about building a better future for humanity and society. The voices you heard at the beginning of this episode are leaders in our industry, our supply chain, who run the gamut from the VP of Global Design at Lee to people who run sustainable mills and manufacturing, talking about how our industry is changing. And that's why we launched the podcast. We want to talk to you about this beloved fabric, its impacts, and share the stories of how people up and down the supply chain are working to make it better, better for the world, better for the environment, and better for you. Today on the podcast, we're going to walk you through a brief overview of the denim supply chain and all of its impacts. If you're in the industry or in the know, a lot of this won't be new to you, so you can feel free to move on to episode 2, where we dive into Indigo Dye with our Chroma and Stony Creek colors, or stick with us. If you found your way to this podcast because you wear denim and you're trying to be more sustainable but don't know where to start, then this episode is for you. And to help me level set, we wanted to bring in an all-around denim expert, someone who has been in the industry for a long time. So let me introduce Andrew Ola, founder of Kingpins, the world's premier denim trade show. Hello, Andrew.
Hey, Rowan. How are you?
I'm doing good, thanks. I'm doing good. And welcome. We're excited to be kicking off the first episode. And I've been thinking a little bit, you know, at least often when we talk to consumers, they might not always be familiar with the particulars with a denim supply chain, you know, from fiber in the field to yarn, fabric, and then cut and sew in factories. There's a lot that's required to make denim. So for episode 1, we really wanted to start this podcast to review all of those steps that are required to bring denim from an idea to a finished product that you would find on a retailer's shelf. And you, with more than 35 years in denim, you're one of the most influential people in our industry. You've consulted for the best brands, mills, and manufacturers, and love to get your perspective.
Happy to answer anything I can, Rowan.
So, Andrew, when you think of making a pair of jeans, where does it start? Supply chains are global and there are many steps involved, but everything begins somewhere.
Well, I think the most important part is that it begins, everything begins in design. I think we have to start from that area, and then the selection of the products, of the fibers that are going to be in the jean. I mean, that's where I think everything starts.
You know, I was actually speaking with Betty Madden, the VP of design at Lee, about this, because all of those designs can influence the outcome of how sustainable that product is.
And I think we've spoiled people by giving them instant, instant abrasion and wash and high low and all these beautiful things that come with kind of honoring your genes and wearing them and letting them tell your story. And so it's going to take some training to get the consumer back to respecting what they get out of what they're buying and what their commitment is to that.
Yeah, Betty. And when I think of you and, you know, your team's role of designers, you know, you have a lot of choices to make that can change the final product's impacts. It really starts with the fiber level choosing, right? Choosing the right fibers, responsible fibers, whether it's a recycled cotton or organic or a new fiber like hemp or from a cotton that was grown regeneratively.
So there's so many choices that start even at the fiber level. And then when you get into the actual fabric, making sure that the fabric's constructed in a way that it's laser friendly. And then once the dye techniques, there's so many amazing things woven into the design process and the early choices that we make from the very beginning that in the end helps save water, helps leave a smaller footprint. We're also investigating and trying to develop trims and hardware and make choices about our patches and hang tags and those types of things that are also wasteful, and figuring out how do we make it holistic, right? So it's a better practice in terms of how we're making the actual gene, but then the hardware that's put on the gene is also as thoughtful as everything else.
Well, the designers have to make a fabric, and then denim always starts with cotton. And so we gotta go down the cotton road. Although denim today is not always 100% cotton, the biggest raw material for any denim product is generally cotton, and I think it's going to be for a really long time. And Rowan, who knows more about cotton than you do? I think you do a lot of work in sustainable cotton.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, I love sustainable cotton, and Lee has a goal to source 100% sustainable cotton by 2025.
Which brings me to ask you, and I have to ask you because I ask everyone this, so what does sustainable cotton mean?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's a great question.
I don't want to stump you, but there it is.
No, I appreciate it, and I think that's something that everyone wrestles with. You know, what does the word sustainable mean? At Lee, we define sustainable cotton as either a recycled cotton fiber, or a cotton that's grown under an approved management scheme like organic or an E3 program. And I think that one of the most interesting things, this idea of getting to traceable cotton grown with regenerative agricultural practices. These practices, and this is what we get really excited about at Lee, the idea of being able to grow cotton in a way that doesn't create a continuous impact on the planet, that has an opportunity to heal the planet, there's an opportunity to take carbon out of the atmosphere and drive it into soils. The biodiversity of soil actually influences the overall sustainability of that cotton crop. So there's a lot of sort of science behind it in terms of, you know, understanding what's going on farm and how those practices translate to the sustainable fiber that we need and want up into genes.
And what you're talking about is super admirable, because it's a tremendous help for climate change. It's a help against the fight against climate change. So that's really terrific.
That's it. That's it. Exactly. You know, it's a lot of people can often be disconnected from agriculture, from farmers, and not understand how they work and how hard they work to feed and clothe us, and how they have the opportunity to play an important role in climate change. Now, not all farmers are into combating climate change, let's be clear, but there's these certain practices that can be utilized, cover cropping, the use of conservation tillage and complex rotation. And when used, those three practices alone, used together in combination to grow cotton, we've actually studied this, and we found that we can put three times the amount of carbon into soils and into the ground than, say, conventional cotton farming, while also increasing yields.
So there you are. You're talking about one of the subjects that I know is dear to your heart, your soil.
soil, microbes, things all in the deep within nature. Yeah, no, I could talk about it forever. And we do have a cotton episode coming up, so I don't want to reveal too much. But I think what listeners need to know is that farmers have an incentive to be more sustainable, to be more efficient, and that less fertilizer, less pesticides they use, the more money they save. If their farm is sustainable, then they can pass it down to the next generation, just as their parents passed it down to them. I spoke with my friend Eugene Pugh, whose family farm is located just outside Memphis, Tennessee, about this particular topic.
You know, I don't even know of a corporate farm personally. You know, they're all family farms is what they are. You know, no matter what the size of the scale the operation is, I mean, it's all, you know, it's a family operation. So, it, you know, that's what it's all about at the end of the day. It's just, you know, it's all of, you know, we're all one big family, and you know, we're just trying to make it to the next year and the next generation.
So once you grow the cotton, you gin it, and that's where it's cleansed and cleaned, and then it's shipped to a denim mill where it's spun into a yarn. Many listeners might think of it like a string, but in the industry, the thread that's used in making denim weaving is called a yarn.
And this is where, when I think of a yarn spinning mill and I think of all the spindles and the individual rotors, there's a lot of energy that's used in this part of the process.
There is. But there's a lot of energy used, but there's even more energy used for the next step, which is the big step, which is dyeing the yarn. So you have this thread or this yarn, and you need to make it blue. And for any textiles, there's two types of yarn. There's generally a yarn that's used for the warp, and there's a yarn used for the weft. And if you're thinking about weaving, the warp yarn is what's held stationary and under great tension in the frame of the loom, while the weft yarn is drawn through the warp yarns over and under. And that's called weaving, inserting the weft yarns across the warp yarn.
Yeah, I mean, it's the warp yarn that's dyed with indigo. Only the warp yarn gets indigo. And there's a quick little trick that I learned. Actually, I learned when I walked my first denim mill. That would have been White Oak and Cone's White Oak facility in Greensboro. But if it's weft, it's left. I mean, that means it's the horizontal yarns, and the warp yarns go up and down. The weft yarns go left and right. But it's the warp yarn that gets the indigo, yep. Right, Andrew?
Yep, the warp yarns get the indigo, and the indigo, one of the beautiful parts of indigo dye is that it actually has no affinity. So in other words, it doesn't shake hands well with cotton. So as you dye it, it's got to be dyed multiple times because it keeps rejecting it. And so you dye it many, many times to get the color to stay on.
It just keeps caking on, right? It just keeps like adding layers and layers. And that's when we think of traditionally the indigo dyeing process and the dye boxes. There's these boxes that sit on the dye range with indigo and chemicals and water. And these 300-foot long machines, right, with sometimes as much as 12, 14, I don't know, maybe as many as 20 dye baths. They're really just boxes of water, chemicals, and indigo.
Yeah, the process is you basically put the yarn inside the indigo, and then you put the indigo up in the air to what we call sky to put it in the air so it oxidizes and it goes back and forth inside. Anyway, these boxes are where a lot of the impact of dyeing comes from. If the wastewater isn't disposed correctly, it's just allowed to go into nature. Well, that's a huge, huge environmental mess. Blue rivers. And there's a documentary called River Blue. It's a few years old, but it does a good job of framing up this issue that people might want to see. Yeah.
I'm actually glad you brought that up. We spoke with Roger Williams, who produced that documentary, for a later episode. And it was so interesting to hear his perspective on how the industry has changed since the film came out. And it's changed in a positive way. There are precautions that can be taken. You know, companies that care will review wastewater records from suppliers in a standard compliance process. But it's unfortunate when a couple actors can paint a bad reputation for the entire industry.
Yeah. I mean, so many things in the industry are changing, and movies like that make an impact in the change. There have been like revolutions in denim dyeing over the last few years. It's just crazy what's going on.
Yeah. And I think one of the biggest revolutions is foam dyed denim, which I'm obviously close to. We will discuss in a future episode, but it's worth noting that it is possible to dye denim with a much smaller footprint. These are some of the changes that Andrew's referring to. In fact, at Tejidos Arroyo, the first mill to dye denim with foam, we saw a 60% decrease in energy use, a 60% decrease in waste use, And we saw a 100% decrease in the amount of water needed for the dyeing part of that production process. I spoke with Jose Royo, the sales director there, about the difference between traditional dyeing and foam.
The traditional system, you use a lot of water, thousands and thousands of liters of water, a lot of chemicals, and a lot of energy. Foam dyeing is no water in dyeing, zero water in dyeing. It's much faster. We can go up to 3 times faster than the traditional speed. Chemical and energy reduced by 60 to 75%. And what is the most important thing? There is no waste water. In traditional system, we spend thousands of liters to clean that water. It's a total revolution. It's a new textile business. We're not talking about the traditional textile business. This is a new ballgame.
And it's important to note that the foam dye denim is just the start. There are other revolutions in dyeing that are also happening. We'll be exploring that for this season of the podcast. What's the next step in the process, Andrew?
Once the warp yarn is dyed, you move into weaving, which, similar to yarn spinning, the impact is in the energy used. Most denim mills today are using conventional energy, a fossil fuel energy. That's basically that.
Right, but then you have fabric. Ultimately, the result of that mill process is a usable fabric construction for cut and sew.
Yep, for jeans. And yeah, the fabric is shipped to the manufacturer who cuts and sews it into jeans. And then those jeans go to an industrial process called finishing, which can involve all sorts of different things.
And this ties back to our earlier conversation about connecting back to the designer, that those choices that the designer made at the very beginning of the life cycle around shading, whiskering, abrasion, trims are all added by that manufacturer.
Yep. There's generally a dry processing and a wet processing in the laundries or the finishing facilities. And the dry processing historically has included sanding, whether it's done by hand or with power tools. In fact, today people are starting to use robots. So that's a big evolution. Obviously, a completely different story. Basically, they use the process, no matter who does it, uses sandpaper to sand away the indigo dye, making the areas where this sanded lighter, with the idea that that makes the jeans look like they've been worn before or lived in. These days, a lot of manufacturers are moving towards lasers, another new technology, which allows for very quick, consistent distressing and makes the ambient air quality in the factory much cleaner.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's important to note that lasers can do a lot, right? Like, they're cool. I mean, they're lasers. And how amazing that we have access to this technology that reduces air pollution in a factory environment that results in cleaner air for the employees.
And the other part of finishing is the wet process. Sorry to go on, but the wet processing is still to be discussed.
Yes, this happens in big laundry machines, right? Like similar to what you might have at home, but much, much bigger, like hundreds of pairs of jeans bigger. You know, wet processing includes what is called desizing, which removes a starch-like compound that was added to make yarn easier to weave and fabric easier to cut and sew. And this laundry processing also helps wash down denim, you know, getting it to the desired shade and characteristics.
Yeah, that's where the original terminology to stone washing comes in well. Historically, manufacturers have actually added pumice stones to the laundry machines, which accelerates the fading and softening of the jeans. And there's also discharge washing, which can remove the color from the selected areas of the jeans. This has traditionally been done with chemicals like potassium permanganate.
Right, Andrew. Yeah, you know, it's a well-known industry fact that the water consumption in the laundry process and the chemicals used to make the different aesthetic qualities of denim are the most common environmental impacts of this finishing stage of denim production. I caught up with Alice Tonello, the R&D manager at Tonello, who's an international leader in the production of garment treatment technologies like industrial washers and lasers.
You know what? The matter of sustainability... It was efficiency, in my opinion. Also, just to give you an idea, when we designed our machine, we always thought about water reduction, chemical reduction, and of course, create a safe process for the workers and consumers. After that, let's say we started to understand about the sustainability, but personally, I would prefer to speak about the broader concept of responsibility.
What products does Tonello have to work on this? You know, the efficiency, the sustainability, and the responsibility.
I'm so happy to speak about our technology. All-in-One System is a machine with all the latest sustainable technology inside. We can use in the same machine technology like ozone water. So we inject ozone during the washing process to clean the garment and to create a really nice cut. We can use also ozone in air, dry ozone, to create a kind of a bleach, but completely without chemicals. In the same machine, we have also Core, that is a nebulization system for the create a kind of fog, let's say, to nebulize different kind of products.
Whoa, that's great. I heard a lot of interesting sustainable technology that you're putting into washing machines. Ozone in water and ozone in air to replace typical bleach applications. Nebulizing fog, that's just fun to say. I'm pretty sure that I don't have a nebulizing fog button on my home washer. And when we think about when we washed garments 40 years ago versus today, what do you think the evolution has been? Today we have garments that have less than what? Less than 10 liters per pair for a wash. Versus what were we seeing 40 years ago?
We can say, let's say, versus 100 liters of water.
100 liters.
Versus 150 years. Many years ago, we used to have in the laundry the barrel machines with a very, very high liquoration. So the average of water consumption per pair of jeans, it was a minimum 100 liters.
Wow, think of that progression. That is just plain inda good. I mean, come on, a wash formulation that used to take 100 to 150 liters per pair in an older washer machine technology, like a belly washer, Alicia referred to them as bottom washers, that's been replaced by a sophisticated front loader machine with all kinds of tech. Welcome nebulization. That results in less water, less chemicals, and a more efficient supply chain. So, Andrea, when I think about the consumer, and the consumer's got a lot of power, the consumer has a lot of opportunity to get engaged here, what are some of the choices that consumers can make that can reduce their impact on the environment as it relates to their denim?
Wow, there's a lot they can do. And the first thing they can do is think really carefully about the way they handle their jeans when they wash them, even if they wash them at all. Obviously, you can wash your jeans every time you wear them. You can wash them once every year. You can wash them once every 7 years. And you can wash them in hot water. You could dry them or not use a dryer or wash them on cool water and hang them. But years ago, someone said, you can freeze your jeans to me. And I said, freeze your jeans? Well, that seemed to make sense to me. That seemed like a really cool idea. Because if you freeze it, in my mind, it meant all the microbes would all freeze to death. And your jeans, if you wore them for a long time, they wouldn't smell because you'd frozen all that stuff off. So I had this really beautiful fridge in New York, and I put them in my freezer and brought them out 2-3 days later. And like 3 hours later, they warmed up and there was no smell and they were clean and they felt clean. I put them on. But the next day I realized my fridge was broken. And I thought, I wonder if that's related to what I just did. Because it's like a really great fridge. I mean, anyway, I figured, I don't know, I never really knew. So then I thought the only way I could test that theory was to do it again. So I had the repair guy come out, fix my fridge, And then about a month and a half later, my jeans were kind of dirty again. So I thought, let me try that again. So I put them back in the freezer. And of course, the next day, the freezer broke again. And then I realized that the particles of the jeans come off with the dust of the indigo in the freezer comes off and goes inside the system. So the lesson is, if you don't want to fix your freezer two times, is you put it in a Ziploc bag, bang, you got perfectly good jeans.
That's great. That's great. That's a recipe for cleanliness.
But scientists have told me that the freezer will only kill some of the problem. So they really recommend that you wash your jeans.
Right.
Cold water.
Cold water, exactly. Yeah, and it's funny too, because you know why it could kill some of the microbes, and there we are on microbes again. But you know, it's there's also soils and stains and other things too, right? Like there's like the heavy particles. It's not going to remove clay, right? But when
I got really excited about the freezer idea because I thought socks would be perfect for the freezer, right?
That's right. But it is interesting too, because like you mentioned cold water wash, you know, I know NC State did a study 2 years ago, 3 years ago now, and they looked, it was actually a really cool study. They polled students in the dorms about their attitudes and beliefs about the effectiveness of cold water wash. And the results were amazing because in all reality, with current soap formulations and the way that the effectiveness of, you know, your home laundry machine, the cold water wash is just as effective as a hot water wash. Now, I know that is like, what are you kidding me? Like hot water, right? Like hot water, you always put things in hot water that you want to get really clean and sanitary. But their studies revealed something different. Their studies revealed that that a cold water wash is effective for cleaning jeans. And think of all that water savings. Think of all the energy savings that could happen if we wash our durable goods like denim in cold water. It's impressive.
Totally. Totally.
And when you think about, you know, end of life, like what do we do when the day of the gene is over? What do we do when the life cycle and the usefulness of that gene comes to a close? What are our options as consumers?
Well, there's no structure in our industry for that. I talked to the City of New York Sanitation Department about it because I wanted to collect jeans from New York City because all these jeans are collected in garbage and no one really knows where they go and just not even dealt with. They don't separate at all. In other countries, they do separations much better than we do. There is no structure. There needs to be an infrastructure built for separating a lot of our waste so that we can reuse it and do things with it that are positive. I went to a factory, you know, the Lenzing factory in Austria, and 60% of their energy comes from waste. And I was like, wow, waste is such a great thing. And there's so much waste in the developing nations. And they said, no, you need to collect it properly first. So the use of our waste is guided by and run by our ability in how we put it away when we throw our garbage out. And so I think that's really a whole structure that needs to be built.
Yeah, it's so true. I mean, you think of waste is most usable when we can characterize it and group it into qualities and types and figure out what to do with it next, right? Whether it's waste to energy or, you know, this emerging concepts around circular economy, or how do we take something like, it's really easy when you think of the electronics industry. There's an infrastructure, to your point, there's an infrastructure in place. Now, whether that's wholesome and complete and absent of any big issues, that's another conversation. But, you know, there's deconstruction of circuit boards, of circuitry and wiring and components, and the reuse of electronics. And we just simply don't have that. You know, it seems like there's a gap in between today and the vision that we might have for a circular economy.
But I think the future is going to be that we build garments that are easily to be ripped apart. And we build garments with information in the garments, so that we know what the garment's made up of, and so that the garment can be reused for all sorts of positive things. I think we're on the threshold of a new world, and it's quite exciting to me.
Information in the garments. It feels like your garment could talk to you. What would it say?
One day, I think so.
Right.
I think one. Well, it should tell you what's in it, so that you can deal with it on the second end level.
Yep.
You know, I think there's just, once you know what's inside something, then you can actually deal with it from a waste point of view and turn it into another product. Because at the end of the day, that's what we're trying to do, is to take, is a society, not just in the jeans world, but in every product that you see around you. when we're done with that product, we'd like to be able to use that product to make another new product. This idea of throwing garbage and throwing it away is like so 60s and 70s. The future is going to be how we take everything that's around us, and it's kind of like the bowling ball. It's going down the aisle, and it keeps turning, and it's going to turn into something else and turn into something else. That's the hope, I think.
Yeah, yeah. From one cradle to the next cradle. This idea that in some ways, if the product can tell us where it came from, what it was made from, it's, you know, its constituent parts, you know, maybe who knows about its chemistry and its formulation of the chemistry, then we are all that much more informed to be able to take that product and, you know, as you said, like the bowling ball, you know, turn it into the next thing, the most appropriate next thing. I'd like to give a special thanks to Betty Madden, VP of Design at Lee, Eugene Pugh, a sustainable cotton farmer from Tennessee, Jose Royo, Sales Director at Tejidos Royo, and Alice Tonello, the Manager of R&D at Tonello. The denim industry is more than 150 years old, and it's complicated. It has a history that, well, we can't change it, but we can change, and we are changing its future. Through each stage of the denim-making process, there are challenges, but there are also opportunities. From more purposeful design to land stewardship practices in cotton growing, we can make a difference. And it doesn't end there. Cleaner manufacturing processes and factories and wastewater treatment combined with how we, as wearers and consumers of denim, wash our clothes at home, we have an opportunity to conserve water. Water that is now available for agriculture, wildlife, other industries, and local communities. So I hope you join me on this journey. Remember, I'm an industry insider and a long-term denim fan. So you're going to hear from me about what I love about jeans and the jeans business, as well as what I want to see change. We're going to talk about some of the challenges in the business and hopefully figure out how to tackle some of those together. I'm going to introduce you to the people who are looking at those key challenges and reframing them as opportunities. The Indigood Podcast is a production of Lee and Kingpins. Our program is produced by Allison Nieder and Jordan Brewster, with the help from O'Brien, O.B. Phillips. Andy Eversaw composed our theme music and hosts his own podcast at banjoearth.com. Paul Bunn was acting as project advisor throughout the duration, and technical direction and editing for this program was done by Benji Johnson from Earth Tones Recording Studio. Special thanks to Andrew Olaf from Kingpins for your leadership, and Chris Waldeck, Executive Vice President and Global Brand President for Lee Jeans, for your continued support in all things Indigood. I'm your host, Rowan Atwood, and thanks for joining us.